check one, two, one, two. It's like this giant TV, but it's like this TV watching.
It's a monstrous TV, but
like, I know, this is going to be my new classroom space.
Oh, and you're going to be like, we're sitting here in a bank vault.
Forever greater and greater bioregionality. And by 40 though.
But then really haven't figured out just in time for the midlife crisis.
And then nothing works. Cause you figure, you know, there's nothing to really figure out. Okay.
Alright, this is round two of episode number two. This is Uproot Your Life, and we have Asia Dorsey with us.
Broadcasting from a bank vault.
A bank vault this time for everybody.
Yes, we are at the Five Points Fermentation Commercial Kitchen space at 970 Yuma.
Great setup, great kitchen.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Alright, well, let's get started. So I think a good place to start is just kind of like tell us a little bit about yourself, your story. So maybe just where are you from originally?
Yeah. So I grew up in the Five Points of Denver. Yeah, I'm from here.
Okay, sweet.
So you ended up going to school in New York, though?
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So what sort of drove you to New York, and then where did you go from there, and then what brought you back to Denver?
Yeah, I wanted to get as far away from Denver as possible, and I went to New York to become a slam poet. I ran the slam poetry at Thomas Jefferson, where I went to high school. And I was like called by this show called Death Poetry. And I would watch it every single week with my grandma on the phone. Like, Grandma, did you hear that? She was like, oh my God. It was just like our thing. I loved it. I had wanted to be a lawyer since I saw Aaron Brockovich I wanted to be an environmental attorney. And so, yeah, I got into all the schools I wanted to get into, and I went to New York. I came back to heal. I developed life-threatening depression and all sort of mental health things, and so I needed to come back home to heal.
Was it a healing place for you when you came back? Because you wanted to leave so badly when you did.
Yeah. It was definitely dealing with the demons from my past. Dealing with the relationship to my mother. Mm-hmm. That was some of the other work that I had to do, right? So we have our work, which is our jobs, our careers, school, all this external kind of thing. And then we have the work, which is our soul work. Mm-hmm. And this is healing the relationships with our families. This is learning how to relate to ourselves in a way that's not commodity. That's not the expectations of others. This is the big work of being fully human. And a fully expressed human. So yeah, that was the big work that I needed to do back home.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So when did food and sort of, I guess, sustainability and then even leading into fermentation? When did that start coming into everything?
Oh my goodness. So I grew up in this household full of women, beautiful black women, who took care of my every need at all times.
Wow.
For every, like, they, you know, my grandmother had not graduated high school. My mother had not graduated high school. They were like, we want you to go to college. Your job is to go to college. And so they made it so that I didn't really have to, I didn't have chores. I was an only child. Like, I just, like, focused on school, and I excelled. And so, like, I had a disdain for cooking and cleaning. I was like, I don't do that. That's not. but in college, I destroyed my body. I did not know how to eat. I didn't know any of the things a person is supposed to know to take care of themselves, because I thought that I was responsible for my own power. But actually, I was standing on the shoulders of the women in my family. And once I didn't have them to stand on, like, I was just out there ridiculous. So I took one food studies course, similar to you all. I was so extra in college. Like, I would take 20 credit hours every semester because I was just like, I wanted to. So I took one class, agriculture, in the 20th system. It was like food systems, agriculture in the 20th century. And I was like sociology, like really like hardcore, you know, environmental studies, of course, because I've always done environmental work. But I took this one food class and it was like, I was so dead in college. Like, I was doing so many amazing things, but I couldn't, my soul was not in my body because I was depressed. And so I was a super activist and but this one class, sitting in there learning about, you know, the creation of the Dust Bowl or the story of milk or like, Coca globalization. And I was finally, there was this thing that like I could take all of my desperate knowledge and focus it in food. Food became the focal point where I could use my social analysis. Anyways, long story short, this is a long story, but I'm gonna shorten it. Omnivore's Dilemma, Polyface Farm. Permaculture. That's food. I met my mentor Kay Baxter in Australia, and I knew she was it because
this is permaculture, right?
Yeah, this is. I was at the Permaculture Research Institute of Australia, in New South Wales, and this woman Kay Baxter came in, and I found this cookbook in this random place, and there were all these vegans there, and they were just. Getting on my nerves. The whole, they're just so new agey and just annoying. And I was just so homesick. But I found this one cookbook and the first like thing was like, it was like butter. Ooh, I was just like, wow, she's using butter. And I just started going through it and there's like recipes for liver and all this stuff. And I just felt so, I like, oh my God, nothing had validated my home culture. This cookbook was like, my grandmother's cookbook, like my home food. And then the woman who wrote the cookbook came there the next day.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Yeah, and so she asked me to come and live with her, and it was there that I learned about the link between gut health and mental health. And so that's when I started healing my gut with food. Yeah.
And so was that the kind of going into herbalism, like through permaculture into that, or was that more internal
so,
healing first?
Yeah, so I learned everything about microorganisms and about the enteric mind and about healing my gut, and I started fermenting, and I came home and I started this fermentation company, Five Points Fermentation, and then I met this beautiful, amazing, radical-ass woman named Cherie Brown, who is a local poet right here in Denver, a friend of Mike Words and Damien. We started talking about, like, you know, ancestral knowledge, and finally we have this Afrofuturism book club, and we were like, let's do this. And so we started Ancestral Herbalism. And it was a collective right here in Denver where we got herbalists from Colorado to come and teach us. And so, we did that for almost a year or 2 years. I think it was a year. And every month we met and we learned new stuff. And that really kind of kickstarted the move into herbalism. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What are some of your, I guess, favorite things that you learned, like, through that?
I think it whetted my appetite. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of interesting things, but I didn't really get it. It was a very new sort of thing. What it did do, though, was that it gave me some really important leads. And it was through that I started studying alchemy, and then fermentation is a part of alchemy. And I was like, and so then it was like this, like, reaffirmation. And then alcohol is made by fermentation, and that's how I make my tinctures. And it became this whole thing of, it was everything I was already doing. Everything that I know about food translates perfectly to herbs.
And so it just came full circle.
Full circle. Okay. That is 360.
Quick question, and this mm-hmm. might be a little bit of a detour, but, like, can you talk a little bit about alchemy and, like, how that informed your life, or, like, what sort of things you learned from that?
Yeah. Alchemy is, people think it's like a proto, like it's a pre-science, but actually alchemy and chemistry, though chemistry came from alchemy, alchemy is a completely different epistemology. It's a completely different worldview, and it's a completely different way of thinking about plants and medicine. And so what I practice personally is I create spagyrics. And so a spagyric is when you take a plant, you harvest it according to the stars. It sounds really woo-woo, and I know how woo-woo I sound, and I just don't care anymore. You know, I don't care anymore. But yeah, so you harvest the plant according to its principles, and through a multi-step process, some of which can last years or more, you separate the plant into its soul, its spirit, and its salt. You got the sulfur, the mercury, and the salt principles of alchemy. And so you separate them out, you purify them, and then you recombine them. And it creates a medicine that's greater than the sum of its parts. And it's far more powerful than the original plant itself. And so alchemy is just, it's for me, I'm learning that I am a maker. I know how to grow food. I know so much stuff, but my passion is the creative process, that part where the human hand engages with the life force and creates that new thing. And so my specialty is actually medicine making. Mm-hmm. And fermenting food, and I'm a maker. And so alchemy gives me new ways of thinking about making, and ways to be even more intentional than I already am. And I love it, because alchemy is not just a way of looking at making food and medicine. It's also a way of looking at our own process. How do we alchemize our own soul? You know, how are we connected to the universal spirit? And what are we doing to take care of our salt, our body, our bones? You know, everything is a part of the works of transformation. And so alchemy is both a practice to make real food, but it's also a spiritual practice. So that you become gold.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in this whole endeavor into alchemy and also herbalism as kind of like a byproduct of that, if you will, do you have like specific teachers that were really prominent in kind of that development, or is this more of a solo journey?
Yeah, I mean, there's no such thing as a solo journey. I personally am, I'm a scholar, so I read a tremendous amount of articles from databases and research and things like that. But I also, you know, took organic chemistry, and like I have this different depth. My favorite herbalist, her name is Susan Weed. She's my white grandma. And I love her a lot. She practices herbal medicine as people's medicine. And she also speaks the language of nourishment, which is what I learned from Kay Baxter about nourishing the body, just this whole nourishment-based approach to food and nutrition. And so definitely Susan Weed. Junius Manifred is my favorite writer on this Phagyric process, and I've learned a lot from him. And then my homies in this community, Cherie Brown and Sarah Chevelle, oh my goodness. Sarah Chevelle is my favorite kitchen witch. She, like, I had this crushing anxiety. She, you know, I was learning about motherwort, and she had motherwort, but she made it the right way. Because you have to make motherwort the right way, or else the medicine doesn't work. But she made it the right way, and, like, it was her medicine that cured my anxiety. And so Dimia Cruz Montoya, she is a curandera and Chinese medicine doctor right here in Denver. Very inspirational. Her five element theory and presence helped me to move into sort of more Chinese systems of plant medicine. And
what's that? Can you describe that really?
Traditional Chinese medicine?
Or no, the five elements.
The five elements. Well, in the Western context, we have four elements. In Ayurvedic medicine, our four is, you know, earth, wind, fire. Ayurvedic medicine, they have the three elements, kapha, pitta, vata. Chinese medicine, they have the five elements, wood, fire, water, like metal, and like something else. But yeah, air. I don't think air is one of them.
How did that personally translate into your life, that theory that you're talking about?
Well, the fact that we have all these different systems that all work, it tells us something, right? It tells us that there's no culture that holds the monopoly on truth, and that Western medicine is not the only medicine that exists, and it's not the only medicine that's right or correct. But it helped me to understand that each medicinal system has something powerful to offer, but also that I am a baby. I am a baby. You know, you don't just dabble in Chinese medicine. It's a whole worldview. And to really fully respect these cultures, like folks like Udimia have studied, you know, 4 years and been to China and all this stuff. I incorporated some five element theories into my fermentation process, but where the five elements come up for me is in my dream work practice, and helping to, you know, read dream symbols in order to diagnose medical issues in my herbal practice. So that's a whole different thing, but that's where the five elements have been the most useful, is in thinking symbolically about the language of dreams. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you dream often? This is a very side note. We'll come back.
Yeah, we all have eight dreams a night, about eight, and I remember five of them. And so I am a very, very, very active dreamer.
Every night you remember five?
About. Last night I remember three.
So you think even when we don't remember them, we still have eight dreams? We just
Oh, absolutely.
Are unconscious of them.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, everyone dreams, whether or not you remember, and it's a muscle that I teach people to exercise.
Okay, that was my next question. Got any tips for how to remember the dreams?
Have a lot of tips, but you'll have to come to one of my dream workshops to learn it.
Oh, shameless plug.
No shame, that's old systems of Abrahamic traditions that may or may not work. Us. Yeah, let's talk.
Okay.
What other questions do you have for me, Dave?
I wanted to get into your basically herbalism through the feminist lens.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I am a shameless feminist. But I guess you can categorize me better as a Marxist feminist. I'm an old school feminist. I don't really play with the third wavers too much.
What does a Marxist feminist mean exactly?
So we understand the oppression of women as being grounded in the female body and the ways in which the female body has been used to reproduce the labor force. So Marxist feminism looks at sexual subjugation.
You got it.
What's happening? Subjugation.
Yeah.
Yay! So we're thinking about, you know, how are these female bodies interacting with the state apparatus? And you could see Marxist feminism really alive when we're thinking about the bodies of Black women. Literally, slave women were used to reproduce the system of slavery. Right?
Yeah.
So they, literally their bodies were used to reproduce.
Perpetuate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a little bit more complex. There's identity politics, a lot of cultural studies, which is very kind of third wave, very kind of postmodern, nothing exists, like, we're in that. We live in postmodernism, and so it's the coming together of multiple perspectives. A lot of second wave feminists were also Marxists. And the beautiful thing when we talk about the feminist movement is that these are literally moms. Third wave feminists are the daughters of these moms, and the first wave feminisms are the moms of these moms.
Yeah.
So folks like Susan Weed, right? Her daughter is like 50. And has third way. So it's like,
yeah.
We like to think about it all like politically, but it's really like
generational.
It's generational. And so I love my grandma, and I love the grandmas, and I love the medicine and the ideas that they brought into the world. And I'm interested in preserving and exploring sort of the depths of what it was that they were doing for us. So much of the openness of our world is because of second wave feminists and what they created. And so I, you know, am moving into that world. I talked a little bit about my disdain for housework. but I'm learning the power and the beauty, like, in these other things. So, yeah.
You do run a kitchen now, so.
Literally, I have a commercial kitchen, right? This is a combination of my masculine and, no, not going to go there. Marxist feminism. My main goal, honestly, is to transform capitalism. And that is really at the core of all of our politics. That's why I'm interested in the land. That's why I practice herbal medicine as people's medicine. Because I want you to be able to harvest your pharmacy from your backyard.
Mm-hmm. What direction would you see? Or, let's see. Where do you think the biggest problem with capitalism lies?
Capitalism is inherently alienating. So we are separated from self. We practice our identities as mediated through the marketplace. We go to the grocery store and have no idea about where our food comes from. We are separated from the source, which is the earth. Right?
Yeah.
And the earth is not just something to be pillaged. The earth is everything. We are it. How dare we not know them? You know, how dare we exist here and not know, like, the plants that are growing near us? It's just, it's unfathomable to me. And that's what it means to be alienated. People think that, like, having no connection to their food or to plants or their own body doesn't have an impact, but what it creates is this feeling that reality doesn't exist. We're so focused on Facebook and fake friends and all of this, these ideas, right? We're stuck in the road of ideas. But that's because of the alienating process of capitalism. That's because a commodity isn't as juicy as a true love, right? We like to talk about the invisible hand of capitalism. Yeah.
So yeah. Can you explain, like, that link a little bit more in terms of, like, how it is the, like, the way that we commodify, or, like, the way that we use that money system, and, like, how that directly creates that type of situation that you're talking about, the othering?
Well, it's, I think it's best to use a specific example. So let's talk about spirituality as pop culture.
Okay.
Cool. Okay? So this idea that, like, spirituality is what you buy, right, has created companies like Sephora selling witch kits that include herbs like sage, which is native to sort of the West Coast, California native people. The sage, that specific sage, is now becoming extinct because of its commodification. So there's a lot of native practices where you never pay for your herbs. Like, you receive them as gifts from the land, right? And you do that, and you receive it as gifts, but when you're harvesting the herbs, there's rules, right? You don't take more than 10% of what's there. Like, you don't, when you have a relationship with these plants, you learn to harvest them sustainably, and so you don't overexploit the population, and so you and that herb exist as a unit, as a partnership. Right? That is deep relationship. Capitalism is alienating because it removes you, the consumer, exactly, from the process of relationship. Capitalism destroys relationships.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the ways that we become alienated, is we're not connected to the land, which is the source of all of our commodities. Well, even plastic is dead dinosaurs.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what I'm talking about with this herbalism thing. For example, there is a significant difference between lavender essential oil and actual lavender plants.
Yeah.
Do you know how many lavender plants go into a bottle of essential oil?
I do know.
A lot.
Thousands.
Really a lot.
Wow.
We made essential oils before. I have made essential oils before. But I still think that essential, I mean, personally, I think they have a place. I definitely agree with, you know, over-commodification and, like, you know, the rules should still be intact. But also, I think essential oils are, like, potent.
They're actually too potent for lay people who have no relationship to the medicine. And let me give you an example of lavender oil specifically. Lavender essential oil, which is everywhere used as scent, causes young males to develop enlarged breasts. There's so many cases of this happening because people think that this is just a commodity. that it's something to use, that it's just because it's available,
right,
doesn't mean you should use it. And so the impact of working with these powerful plant beings without having that respectful relationship is that they disrupt your hormonal systems and have all of these other consequences.
Right.
And so when the ancients were using essential oils, they were trained, they were practiced. Essential oil is actually in alchemy, the sulfur, the soul of the plant. Essential oils are plant souls. Okay?
And we have commodified that and sell it to the mass markets to people who don't understand.
Who don't understand.
So you think that if that respectful relationship was made first, then one could, like, intelligently and responsibly use things like that?
Yeah, absolutely, because guess what? You can take 3 plants of lavender, fresh, that you grew outside your house.
Yep.
Take the flowers from that plant, put them in pure olive oil that you can get from King's. You can use fancy stuff like ghee that you make from local milk like I do. Or, you can get like olive oil, you pour that over the plant, you let that sit for 6 weeks. And the oils from the plant will infuse into the base oil, which is the olive oil, and it will smell amazing. And guess what? It's just the right amount. It's not too much. And think about how much more sustainable that is. You want to use 1,000 plants, or you want to use 3 plants?
So you think the route to building this type of relationship is being part of the whole process?
Exactly. And even if you personally, like, can't be part of being in relationship with people that are, for example, I'm a maker. So the person who grew Michael Kill, my cabbage for my fermentation company, I didn't grow my cabbages. But I was in relationship with Michael.
Mm-hmm.
And he grew those cabbages in the most respectful and nourishing, revitalizing way. And I took that, put it in my food. And then I was in relationship with the customers that I sold my sauerkraut and my gem to. And that's what I mean about being in relationship, right? This is the thing that transforms capitalism, is relationship. That's why workers' cooperatives will end capitalism as we know it. And that's why my company was a workers' co-op. Because it's the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, and this is what I mean by like alienation and isolation, and you feel lonely even though you're surrounded by people because you're not in true relationship. Because we treat people like commodities. It's just this nastiness. But the lavender example, it's a perfect example, right? Because the best medicine isn't that extra 10,000 plants in a jar. Like it's the best medicine is this. Oh, I have so much to say about essential oils because I practice alchemy, and creating an essential oil is part of the alchemical process. But because I practice alchemy, I've been able to go deeper into understanding what it means to be working with a plant soul.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I get that, like, you don't need that much. Like, essential oil is the medicine of subtlety. Right? It's the subtle medicine. And people be putting a whole ounce in their bath water. Like, what? But that's capitalism, baby. And there are consequences. There are real and actual consequences. Yes.
Well, that seems like a pretty good segue into the current stuff that you're doing now, which Gavin and I really, really are stoked to hear about, which is like the kitchen, sauerkraut business, all of that. So would you mind just kind of giving us a little synopsis of that?
Currently, I have, so, funny thing, so I scaled up, went into, like, massive production of sauerkraut and hated it, scaled way down.
And this is when you had employees and...
Yeah, so when the company was way larger than what it is now, and I decided to do what I actually like, which is to teach. And so now I have a small CSA, and it combines fermentation and durable medicine.
What's a CSA?
Community Supported Agriculture. So I have folks who support me, and every month I make them every season we focus on one herb. And I make a Jun, which is a honey fermented probiotic drink, and with that herb, and they go into relationship with that herb. And so they take the Jun ritualistically, and they're reading about dandelion, because every month I'm writing different articles about it. And they're working with dandelion. Oh, dandelion is going to be our spring one. But so they're working with dandelion. I'm teaching them how to make different dandelion medicines. And so it's this whole immersive experience where folks get to be in deep relationship with dandelion. Because one of the things that capitalism does is it makes us not value the things that are closest to us. And so, for example, the logic of capitalism says that dandelion is worthless because dandelion is abundant. In capitalism, the more of something there is, the less valuable it is. But actually, dandelion is the most powerful medicine.
That's a really interesting flip, like recognizing that what is most abundant as being resourceful rather than what is, like, scarce.
Exactly. Yeah. So we can see scarcity at play in herbal medicine with all these people, like, trying to do the new hip thing. Like, I'm going to do Ayurvedic medicine, even though...
The rare root from South America.
The rare root or all this superfood BS. I hate all of it. Oh, my... Don't get me started. But it's just, like... And then we miss the medicine that's right in front of us. And dandelion is abundant. So guess what? It's not going to go extinct.
Yeah.
You know, like it's, and it grows. It's so available. It's right there. And it's the most beautiful example of the earth as this beneficial force that's constantly providing the medicine that we need. And puts it at our doorstep, and what do we do with dandelion?
Pick it.
Well, okay, that's the cute part.
I know, that's the cute part.
We spray it with poison to try to kill it. But we're killing literally the best medicine and then spending money to buy what's rare, blah, blah, blah. And none of that stuff even works, because guess what? Dandelion has adapted to our specific bioregion to meet our specific needs perfectly. You're not tropical, boo. Why are you taking tropical plants that are grown in the tropics when you live, right? See, don't get me started. This is the conversation, though. This is the conversation about how do we practice deep sustainability in our medicine making? How do we practice deep, and how do we do it? By being in relationship. You can't be in a relationship with a plant that's somewhere that you don't belong to.
So, on that note, do you think the modern medical industry will ever come around to see that type of philosophy, or do you think it's more of a breaking away from the system entirely?
I don't tend to see it black and white. I think that, thank goodness for surgery, listen, modern medicine is wrong in so many aspects, but it has mastered some really important things. I am so happy that I can go to the hospital or any drugstore and get aspirin.
Yeah.
And it's aspirin. And it's aspirin and it's aspirin and it's the same amount. And it's like, oh my, that's so cool. Because sometimes white willow bark has different levels of salicin, so you don't necessarily know how much of that constituent you're getting. But, so aspirin is made from white willow bark, which is the actual plant. But the cool thing is that the way that I make my white willow bark medicine is that you're not dependent on just one constituent anyways. So... Because aspirin will thin your blood. It's just this whole mess. But white willow bark, you'll be good to go. Anyways, I think modern medicine has its place in the art of herbal medicine. But I think that there are a lot of ways in which it does us harm, in which it's not it's not on point, but there is this place of convergence where people, like younger people, people from diverse backgrounds, like a lot of Asian folks, like Indians and East Asians, are moving into Western medicine and transforming it from within, right? Because they know for a fact that plants work because they have that history in their family. And so we're getting more research on herbs and where, but they're still putting it in this reductionist scientific model. And so they're not truly able to access plant medicine the way that I can access it. So, yes, okay. We got a diversity of things. If I get cancer, you know I'm going to take my milk thistle seed tincture along with my chemo radiation. Like, you know it. Like, I don't think we have to choose either or, but
it's like kind of recognizing the values and the maybe, like, losses that each sort of different ways
exactly
of thinking.
Exactly. What we're going for.
It's like we're all trying to get to the same place sort of thing.
Yes. And I think this is the feminist medicinal worldview, right? Like, it's not about either or. It's not about a binary. Right? It's literally about moving towards wholeness. And wholeness means that we recognize both sides or all the sides of each system. And then we could make really informed decisions about our choices. Yes.
Yeah. So, how have you liked this sauerkraut business thing, though, since the downscale?
Since the downscale.
I'd say the June is
very
good.
Yeah, so I am moving out of sauerkraut completely and only towards... I'm actually moving into greater simplicity. And that is, it's so liberating. It's like a breath of fresh air. You know, before I would do this crazy, elaborate, like, da-da-da-da. And I would always feel some kind of way because I never felt like anyone fully saw. Because I would be elaborate, but I would see each individual piece of the process. And each individual piece would be intentional, right? Like, Michael Kill grew my cabbage. Like, I harvested that cabbage. Like, I know how I stored it. And then I fermented traditional German style. And, like, every part of it was so sacred. And then, like, but when people were buying it, it was just like, because I'd make crazy flavors. And that would take the foreground, you know, versus, and so it was just too much. And so now I can be simple. And now I can talk about, like, that relationship to the honey, that relationship to the tea, that relationship to the plant. I don't have to be so extra. And so it's been some of my capital W work is around seeing the sacred in the ordinary and knowing that, like, I myself am valuable without having to be so damn extra, that I'm perfect just as I am, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What a beautiful thing to put out into the world.
I mean, I can't wait for other people to move into that, you know, and stop performing everything and just be in their beingness, you know. But I guess you lead by example.
I guess so. Cool. Well, we are wrapping up here. Mm-hmm. Thank you again, Asia. This has been awesome. But Gavin and I have one final question for you.
Oh,
and
snap.
This one is really pertinent to us as we're moving into other stages of life and other things. Mm-hmm. So here's our question. If you could go back in time and have a conversation with your 19-year-old, younger self or something like that, or just if you had some words of advice for young people like Gavin and I or maybe some of our listeners, what would that be, you know, in coming into, like, for us, it's a different stage of, like, young adulthood, which can be a pretty rough and, you know, roller coaster-like time. So, yeah. What would you say?
Yeah. I don't know if giving you all advice at this time is useful at all. Because even when I tell you that it's not as big a deal as you think it is, you're still not gonna absorb that, right? Because you can't see the larger arc because you're in the experience right now. So the only thing that I would give to you, and the only thing I would, you know, go back and tell myself is, you know, your body, your physical body, and your relationship to that body, that's the most sacred relationship you're ever going to have. And that's the most important thing. Do not destroy your body for any job, any partner, any... Just love your body. And loving your body means taking time out of your busy schedule to take a breath. It means taking time out of your busy schedule. Be like, this is when I cook my own food. I wish that little Asia, younger Asia, like, got to engage with real, tangible, physical things. Y'all are in university. You'll be engaged. You'll be learning brand new ideas. You'll be in your head so much. And my advice is, this is the time when you can learn to be in relationship with your body and set a foundation that will last you well into your middle age life. You don't want to move into your 30s having to correct past mistakes. And I think that engaging with your body will help you to know what's real. Learning in your body what no feels like. Learning in your body what yes feels like. I would encourage you to ground. I know it's probably not going to happen. I know that y'all are going to be hectic and doing the most and stressing. Everything's giant. But in that stress, just give yourself a little bit of time for your body. That's what I would give myself.
Cool.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Thank you
so much. Yeah, I definitely appreciate this opportunity to speak with y'all.
Asia, this was awesome. Thank you so much.
Yeah.